It is Wednesday, November 11th, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Washington Bureau Chief of The Intercept, the Democratic soul searching. Meanwhile, the Republican fraud, election fraud grift begins to crumble while COVID rages out of control in the upper Midwest and the vast majority of our country. Trump fires the civilian leadership of the military, installs a bunch of cronies. Early polls show Georgia's runoff super tight. The EU charges Amazon with antitrust violations. And the Supreme Court hears that ACA case indicates the desire to crush the law may very well fail. The Alaska Senate race called for the Republican Dan Sullivan. California fails to reverse the odious Proposition 13, and a new study calls for limiting indoor capacity to fight the COVID surge we are facing. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us today. The ongoing story of Donald Trump hiding in the White House, refusing to come out, refusing to concede. I mean, frankly, I don't think anybody, I personally don't care if Donald Trump ever concedes. But more importantly, it is to allow the next administration to begin to do the work to deal with, at the very least, a raging pandemic in the country. We have a situation now where we're on the brink of various states having hospitals completely overrun. We are now at the highest level of hospitalization we have been at during this pandemic in this country. And this does not look to be a momentary blip. This is not, we're just going to peek over where we were in April and drop back down. The trajectory of this thing is starting to look like a rocket, frankly. The seven-day average is now at 123,000. Almost every day now we're hitting new records for infections. On Tuesday, the hospitalizations hit 62,000. That is a record. Also, the new daily cases passed 139,000 for the first time. The number of people hospitalized with coronavirus has more than doubled since September. That's 5 weeks ago. And understand this happens, this goes exponentially. So it's not going to take 5 weeks for potentially this to double again if we stay on the same trajectory. And all of the headwinds, if you will, are against us. As the weather gets colder, there's reason to believe that transmission becomes easier, both as a function of people being indoors more and as a function of the dryness of the air, the lack of humidity in the air. And then in terms of hospitalizations, particularly in those parts of the country where apparently people just feel like they cannot catch it, you're going to have a typical rate of hospitalizations for the flu, which is going to eat up more bed space, right? I mean, if you have people who are at least wearing masks, they're maintaining some type of social distance, They are washing their hands. They're getting flu vaccines. Hopefully, the number of flu hospitalizations will be lower because this is all about capacity in the hospitals. And in El Paso, they're having to bring in more refrigerated mobile morgues. And we're going to start seeing this around the country. It's a real problem. And so I don't care if Donald Trump comes out and congratulates Joe Biden. Who cares? I mean, I understand the norms and the accoutrements of a peaceful transition of power. But the real issue is sign over all of those assets that a presidential transition team needs to start building their capacity. I don't know. We'll ask Ryan Grimm about these firings at the Pentagon, if they were just out of spite or if it's not like a two-step spite and a function of making it that much harder on a new administration. But it's appalling. It is appalling what we're seeing from Republican lawmakers. And what is even more appalling in some respects is the both sides. The one aspect of it is the both-siderisms of this. Put up that tweet, Matt, of Howie Kurtz. Is he the media reporter? What is some reporter for Fox? Like, I don't know, like the culture. What is Howard Kurtz's actual title these days? He used to be like a media reporter for Fox News. I don't know if what he's doing now, but this is a perfect example of like, are you serious? Put this up where he is equating what Donald Trump is doing from Trump's GSA barring the Biden transition officials. This is the Government Services Administration not signing off and allowing all the resources that you need so that our next presidential administration can start the job running, essentially. That is equal to, are you ready to this? To Whoopi Goldberg telling Donald Trump's voters to suck it up. Both sides are playing the politics of payback. I mean, on one side, you have millions of dollars, resources in terms of office space, in terms of the actual functioning of our government being withheld. And on the other side, you have one of the hosts of The View being mean. How much more twisted can you get? How do they get away with this? One, I think there's a lot of issues in terms of our society, broadly speaking, and there's problems within the media. But also part of it is a function of the way that Democrats are reacting to this. Let's play this clip from Chris Coons, and I'll show you how sort of like how Chris Coons here is, what he's doing here is indicative of a major problem that Democrats have had for at least for the past two decades, as far as I can tell. But it's stunning to see this.
This is an uncertain time, these next 71 days. I think it is time, past time, for Republican leaders to stand up and say we should accept the results of this election. And I continue to work with colleagues to urge them to do so.
Do you see any evidence that Republican leaders are doing that? We'll do that.
I see no evidence of voter fraud in the key states that would need to have their outcomes changed. And I so far see little evidence of any Republicans standing up to the president. There have been four so far here in the Senate. My hope is that this is the week when that will begin to turn, as it is clear there is no possible pathway for the president to overturn these results. And we are beginning to threaten the foundations of our democracy, which is a regular, orderly, peaceful transfer of power after every quadrennial election.
What are they telling you behind the scenes?
bluntly, that they accept that. I mean, they call me to say, you know, congratulations, please convey my well wishes to the president-elect, but I can't say that publicly yet. And wow. These are conversations best kept private.
Okay, and when will they be able to say that publicly?
I My job here, I think, is to continue to urge them privately to do the right thing and to help the president accept reality and to help their caucus stand up publicly. Because, frankly, the transition is going to be chaotic at best if it doesn't get moving.
There it is, right? Everything is fine until Chris Coons basically says, look, they're just a little bit nervous. Everybody understands that they're a little bit nervous. And the bottom line is the way that politics works is if the Republicans, if Mitch McConnell, if all of these Republicans are going to run this play where they publicly say we need to stall, we need to wait, there could be, we're going to basically undercutting a Biden administration, working up their followers into a lather. If the Republicans are going to do that, then it's incumbent upon the Democrats to make them pay a political price. So the answer to is, what are they saying to you privately, is nothing. Nothing. You want me to reveal that privately they're actually good guys. Privately, they're a little concerned about this. They're not monsters, whatever it is. The answer to what they're saying to you privately is nothing. I haven't heard from them. They are hell-bent on this because you make them pay for what they're saying publicly. And if those Republican lawmakers want to go on to Fox News and say, you know, privately, I actually did say to Chris Coons that I wanted the president, then they can do that. But you don't let them off the hook. And you see this from reporters. Jake Tapper had a long piece that was good in terms of expressing the outrage about the fact that Biden is Trump is not leaving the office. But then you don't report privately. They're actually not being so irresponsible. No, it is their public actions that are problematic, and you make them live with those and pay for those. You don't let them off the hook. This is the Democrats lack a political instinct. And I don't, there is not a single moderate voter in the entire country who's going to go, I sort of think that Chris Coons is holding back and he's not telling us what they're saying privately. No, you do not let them off the hook. If they're going to make any type of move, even if you're going to lose in this situation, which is we're losing days that the Biden administration could ramp up, you make them pay a price politically. That's the way you do politics. Now, a word from our sponsors. You've heard me say many times I feel completely overworked. I'm overwhelmed many times. Got my kids yelling at me. Got to deal with my parents, my, you know, just on and on and on. The cats. Well, how do I find time to sit down and read things that are not like at the top of my list of priorities? It's an app called Blinkist. It's for anyone who cares about learning, but doesn't have a lot of time to do so. It takes the key insights and ideas from 4,000 nonfiction bestsellers in over 27 categories, gathers them together in 15-minute text and audio explainers, or what they call blinks. So what a blink does, it allows you basically, takes all the key takeaways. So it allows you to get through a topic quickly. You don't need the purple prose, as it were. Blinkist has even teamed up with popular podcast creators to blink those for you too, so you can get to the heart of a podcast episode fast. Are they doing ours? That might make up for my slow cadence. 15 million people are already using Blinkist to broaden their knowledge in 27 nonfiction categories like self-improvement, management, mindfulness, and more. Like I say, I use Blinkist. Just trying to do a little bit of exercise these days, but I'm not trying to do that much. But 15 minutes, I can listen to the key takeaways of a book. Like, you know, I keep talking about that Tim Ferriss book all the time, but Why We Sleep by Matthew Walker. I don't need all the stuff in between. Give me the 15 minutes with the top key messages there. The Barefoot Investor by Scott Pape. I may check it out. I don't like to spend a lot of time reading about investing, but I also feel like sometimes like I should know some stuff. But I'm not going to read Rick Wilson's full book, with all due respect. But I'm curious as to, you know, how he's presenting. Well, Blinkist allows you to do it. You can also use Blinkist Shortcast to quickly catch up on podcast episodes you've missed. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer for just our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/Majority Report. You start your 7-day free trial, and then you get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. That's Blinkist.com/Majority Report. Get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/Majority Report. And I am also, I am not only the proud owner of a Quip toothbrush, but both my children have Quip toothbrushes. My ex-wife now has a Quip toothbrush. My sister has a Quip toothbrush. And why? Because good health starts with good oral hygiene. I got fixated on oral hygiene a couple of years ago when I realized like how much money I could end up paying in the dentist. You get older, you get a little worried about it. Well, Quip electric toothbrush has timed sonic vibrations. So when you're dealing with your kid, they have smaller toothbrush heads with your kid. You don't have to have them count or sing the alphabet really fast to get through everything. No, 30 seconds, each quadrant of your mouth, boom, you're done, 2 minutes. They also have anti-cavity toothpaste. They have eco-friendly refillable floss dispensers. They got watermelon toothpaste for kids. He loves it. And what they do is they send you the a new brush head, toothpaste, and floss on a dentist recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5. And shipping is free. Join over 3 million happy customers using Quip at $25. That's where it starts. So if you go to getquip.com/majority right now, you'll get your first refill free. That's your first refill free. Getquip.com/majority, spelled getquip, QUIP.com/majority. Quip, the good habits company. Also, one more day of getting 10% off at comesincolors.com for the masks and for the mask carriers that clip on, or you can wear them around with a lanyard. Comes in colors, and you use the coupon code 4 seasons, one word, 4 seasons. You don't have to put hotel. You don't have to put landscaping. You just use the word 4 seasons. You get 10% off. Great stuff. My daughter is going crazy over that stuff. So it's nice to have a mask holder. All right. I'd like to welcome to the show Ryan Grimm. He is the DC bureau chief at The Intercept, host of the Intercepted podcast, and also author of We've Got People, from Jesse Jackson to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, The End of Big Money and the Rise of a Movement. Ryan Grimm, welcome to the show. Ryan?
Looks like he's still connecting to audio, so hopefully that
okay.
will be...
Well, Ryan, we're watching Ryan connect to audio. He's looking good. He's wore a sport coat today. That's nice. We're still waiting for Ryan to connect. There we go. Ryan, can you hear me?
Hey, yeah, how you doing?
I'm doing well. I gave you a very nice introduction, but your audio hadn't connected yet. You're looking
very
nice.
I'm going to take your word for it.
Very dapper.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us.
Dressed up for you.
Oh, well, thank you. That's very kind of you. I appreciate that. So, Ryan, let's get right into this, okay? I got a couple of questions that I just want to ask as you, as someone who is in Washington around some of the reporting. And then I want to get into this question of the soul searching that we're seeing within particularly the Democratic House caucus. The Senate just seems to be, well, whatever. But one, what can you tell me about what's going on with the Pentagon? Have you in the course of your reporting heard any theories as to like what is the value? Is Donald Trump just doing this out of spite? Are there other members of the administration who are like, well, he wants to do it out of spite, but it's also going to like set Biden back, you know, 4 to 6 weeks, because it's one thing for him to leave Mike Esper in there. It's another to leave in, you know, guys who were calling Barack Obama a secret Muslim.
So at The Intercept, we've been doing some reporting on this over the past several weeks, and it appears like a version of this, you know, has been planned, you know, regardless of the election outcome, that, you know, if he lost, there was all sorts of opportunities for the kind of mischief that you're talking about, and also the kind of mischief that would be much more relevant if the election were closer and, you know, and he had a chance to kind of steal it. But, you know, so those, you know, he had those plans on the shelves. And at the same time, if he was reelected, it was going to be a kind of gloves off second term Trump, where he like
right.
really went to war with his deep state enemies. And in order to win that war was plotting to decapitate the, you know, not just the Pentagon, CIA and elsewhere, and try to put loyalists in there. Although he's kind of running out of 25-year-olds that he can put into these places consistently. So maybe fortunately for him, he's running out of runway, as this is just going to run through January. Now, the way that it's being talked about internally is that he very much wants to get the troops home from Afghanistan by Christmas, and that this is going to help him do that. That's the kind of the way that, you know, his loyalists are selling this internally and arguing that, you know, a lot of the Pentagon brass might try to use the lame duck to drag their feet to keep troops in Afghanistan to a point where then they can, they can pressure Biden to keep that endless war going that much longer. And I don't think we should completely dismiss that. I think that as a matter of fact, that is in general what Pentagon brass does when it comes to this particular war and wars in general. Whether that's Trump's leading motivating factor is quite dubious.
Right. I was going to say, like, I'm fully it's not hard for me to accept the fact that that a military that's been occupying that country now for 20 years is still interested in maintaining that. There's a lot of people making a lot of money off of
right. That, they want another 20 or so.
But the idea that Donald Trump's like, I want to do one good thing before I leave, or I really care that much about policy, and that's what I want my legacy to be, I find that a little bit hard to believe. But
right. But all the incentives are lined up in the same direction. It's also a chance for him to scratch a grievance that he's long held against those folks. I mean,
right.
We had a bunch of reporting a month ago that he talks trash about the military constantly. He's kind of impressed and in awe of some of these generals, the beefy, handsome ones. But at the same time, he thinks they're all idiots and losers and are just looking for their next paycheck, from Raytheon. So this is a way for him to kind of scratch that itch as well.
All right. So just to be clear, this is more fetishistic than fascist. On some level for him firing these people. I really do think he just gets off with it. I think he really just gets off on the idea that he could fire these people, and he thinks, but all right. That was question one. Second one is stimulus. Has there been any, I know Mitch McConnell sort of like on day one before he slid into, oh, wait a second, there's value in here for me to hop on the election denialism train. But for a day, it seemed like he was saying we should really get to a stimulus, and gosh knows what that's going to look like coming out of the Senate. But is there any talk whatsoever? I mean, unemployment is running out and has been running out for people for months in many respects. But it's starting to crest, and we're also starting to see, you know, cuts in states and cities. Is there any talk of a stimulus at all? And do you think it would involve, you know, extended unemployment? Would it involve one-time checks, multiple-time checks?
The talk is that McConnell is very closely watching the polls in Georgia, and pretty much everything he does between now and January 6th, the date of those two elections, Warnock and Ossoff against Loeffler and Perdue, is going to be guided by, you know, his desire to make sure he wins both of those, because he has gotten himself into a situation where if Dan Sullivan has won the Alaska race, he needs to win, right? He needs to win at least one of those Georgia Senate elections to maintain control of the Senate. Republicans are heavily favored in both because of the patterns of turnout in the past, where Republicans come out at higher levels in these runoff elections than Democrats do traditionally. But you can't necessarily take any of that to the bank, because we're in a kind of uncharted right. territory. Are these people coming out without Trump at the top of the ticket anymore? And so, you know, the way that McConnell is kind of fueling the Trump's kind of discrediting of the election is thought to be related to that. You know, if he wants to keep the Trump people angry and engaged, even without Trump around. And so the stimulus, you know, notches into it in the same way. If he feels like talking about a stimulus is good politics, good electoral politics in Georgia, then he's going to talk about the stimulus. If he thinks that passing one is good politics, then he'll do that. So all of it just depends on what Perdue and Loeffler are going to need to win in January.
All right.
So he is talking about a very skinny stimulus, no state and local aid.
Right.
You know, that certainly would have to have, you know, he would insist on liability protections for businesses. And, you know, basically the offer that he was putting up earlier probably
right. so
ratcheted up a little bit.
That raises two things. One is we would have been better off. And by we, I just mean Americans. Basically, it had Pelosi just taken Mnuchin's deal, regardless of what it was at this point, because it was never going to be as good as what McConnell's going to produce. I mean, even, you know, to the extent that that was real. But I have, you know, there's reason to believe that if Pelosi said yes, they would have just come in with that 1.8, because then it would have looked bad for the president. And the president was worried about that. But so put that miscalculation aside by Nancy Pelosi. Is there, and this segues into what I wanted to talk to you about in terms of like this interesting, I think I'm pronouncing it correctly, fight amongst the Democrats. Is there anything that you can point to as someone who is the D.C. Bureau chief of The Intercept that is analogous to Mitch McConnell strategizing to help Georgia? Like any active, like who is the person that is doing what McConnell is doing in the Senate?
So Schumer, to his credit, has been a lot more aggressive lately in trying to push the Democratic messaging in a bolder direction. You know, he came out right after the election saying, you know, what Biden ought to do is cancel $50,000 in student debt. Across the board for everybody by, you know, executive fiat. That doesn't immediately play into a Senate argument, but it doesn't matter, because that kind of pushes out to the public that, look, if Democrats are in control, Democrats are going to wipe out up to $50,000 worth of your student debt. And, you know, there are a lot of people who have more debt than that, but there are a ton, you know, millions of people who would have all of their debt wiped out by that. And that is the kind of thing that Democrats need to do to try to explain to people, okay, why should I bother to come out and vote? What is the Biden agenda that's actually going to help? Now, Schumer has also talked about legalizing marijuana. You know, that is something that you can explain to people as a difference between the party. What is something that you know, voters would actually get if they come out? Biden, on the other hand, doesn't seem like he's taking it remotely seriously. There's some thought that maybe he has PTSD from 1992, where Bill Clinton, after winning, went and campaigned in one of these Georgia runoffs, and the Republican won, and people felt like it made Bill Clinton look bad. And so reverting back to this old politician's way of thinking that the best way not to lose is to never try. Because if you try and you fail, then uh-oh, you're a loser. But if you never tried anything, then hey, you know, you're undefeated.
I think we have definitely talked about over the course of the past 4 years that it at the very least we've characterized as making Donald Trump look weak if he goes in and campaigns in a special election and his chosen candidate loses. It is perceived as a weakness on that part. I mean, so from that respect, I suppose I understand it. But there's a difference, of course, between Biden going into the state to campaign, which I think I saw today some reporting suggested he wasn't interested in doing that, but they're thinking about sending Obama down there. That to me, you know, makes some sense, I guess. But there could be things where he's talking about of what the value of having a Democratic Senate is. And I have not heard that really so much. It's good to see that Schumer's doing that because Schumer's got to worry about his primary. I am of the mind now that I think senators should be facing primaries every 2 years based upon what I've seen it doing in terms of clarifying Chuck Schumer's perspective on this. Let me just get your take on this. So we just watched a clip of Chris Coons before he came on where he was talking about how reprehensible it is that you have Republicans, lawmakers, senators in particular, who are not coming out and telling Donald Trump to give up the ghost and particularly, you know, sign the have the GSA sign off so that we can get this thing going. And then he's asked, what are they saying privately? And he goes, well, privately, they're actually, you know, wishing congratulations to Joe Biden. And they're telling me that they wish this wasn't happening, et cetera, et cetera. Doesn't that undercut the message? Like when they're taking a public position, like, isn't that what, if you're a Republican lawmaker and you're doing this publicly for the 70 million people who voted for Donald Trump or whoever your constituencies are that love Donald Trump, and you're doing it to rile up the base in Georgia, you get to do that publicly, but then you get to cover your rear flank essentially by having Chris Coons go on national television and say, deep down in their hearts, they're actually really nice people and they're congratulating Joe Biden. I mean, doesn't that undercut the message?
It shows that they're not terribly principled in their authoritarianism, I suppose. You're right. You know, but it also does show, you know, how thoroughly Trumpism has taken over this party. And the way that matters is probably not going to be in this attempted soft coup, hard coup that Trump has going on in the background. But every operative who's in his or her late teens, early 20s, who's rising into the Republican Party right now, is watching this authoritarian strain spread and take over the entire party. And that what they're learning is that the way to rise through this party and the values of this party are anti-democratic, are absolutely win at all costs. Democrats are enemies of the people. And what matters is taking power and holding it, even if you have to undo, you know, 200 plus years of democratic institutions in the country.
You know who also learned that lesson was Amy Coney Barrett, Brett Kavanaugh, and John Roberts, who worked on the sort of version one of a power grab 20 years ago down in Florida, as the Supreme Court chose essentially George W. Bush to be president. All right, so let's move to the House and talk about this sort of this fight that has broken out in the House. And to me, which keeps like sort of striking me is this is exactly what we saw in 2018. Where the first month of a democratically controlled Congress was ostensibly dedicated to passing H.R. 1, which was actually a pretty good bill in terms of voting rights, in terms of like ethics, in terms of anti-corruption.
Public financing. Even.
Public financing.
Matching funds for candidates. Yeah.
It was a great bill that nobody heard of because Nancy Pelosi joined in on attacks on Ilhan Omar. And go back, like literally on the day that they had passed that, the top story was about Ilhan Omar. And we're seeing this over again. They're doing it again. They launch into an attack on a, will you tell the story of this phone call that was, and I wonder, you know, I'm always very suspicious about things that, like, we never meant for this to get out, even though we had a half a dozen reporters on the phone at the time. Will you tell that story?
Well, the reporters weren't exactly on the phone, but right. So it's, you know, they used to have caucus meetings in, you know, and soon they'll again be having some caucus meetings indoors, maybe masked up. But what the way that the caucus has been meeting privately is over conference call, and some staff call into these conference calls as well. Although even before it moved to a Zoom conference calls, you were having a lot of members who would text reporters in real time. You know, this is what so-and-so just said. This is what this person just said. Because this one went on for 3 hours, it became kind of a public spectacle. And because it actually mattered and people were really pouring their hearts out, that you started hearing that centrist after centrist, you know, with Abigail Spanberger kind of being the most florid in her denunciations, were coming to the microphone, or I guess the, you know, pressing star one or whatever, to be able to unburden themselves about the burden that progressivism and what they would call socialism, you know, had brought to their campaign, saying that, you know, that because of words like Medicare for all and socialism and defund the police, but they lost a lot of very good members, and they have to stop this right now. And, you know, it's childish and it's unprofessional. It's irresponsible. And you had Rashida Tlaib push back and say, look, we don't know yet. You're launching into this analysis without any of the data. But what we do know is that in precincts like hers and like Ilhan Omar's, you know, turnout climbed in substantial ways, and that, you know, without voters in Philadelphia, Milwaukee, Minneapolis, Detroit, Joe Biden doesn't win, you know, Pennsylvania, right. Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan. And so maybe while there's still these Georgia Senate specials that are still to be decided, let's not, you know, thoroughly trash the progressive wing of the party just yet. So that kicked off this civil war, or this new battle in the civil war. AOC then responded with an interview in the New York Times, and then she was blamed for kind of launching the war, even though it was in response to the letter, I mean, to the call.
And but her response, it seems to me, I mean, because I don't know, was there any candidates that were running on, you know, on a defund the police slogan? I mean, there's obviously this is
no. And actually, so I actually talked to some Republican campaigners about this, and they said the only district where they seriously went in on defund the police was Anthony Brindisi's, because they said he has more of a Trump kind of culturally conservative district where that message would resonate.
Where is Brindisi's?
He's outside New York somewhere, right? Like up in upstate New York, you know, kind of Trumpish area that Democrats flipped in 2018. And so all of the other ones, they studied it hard. They wanted to hit Democrats with the best shot they could. Defund the police wasn't really what was resonating. What they did instead was they support, you know, the law and order, the Trump message of like the Portland chaos is going to come to you. You're not going to be safe in your neighborhoods. You know, Democrats just aren't going to protect you. So it wasn't really around defund the police, and those candidates weren't running on defund the police. Defund the police is a slogan. I think it's not a great slogan. I mean, it's a slogan that came from the ground up from protests. And so what are centrist Democrats saying? Like we can't have, you know, protests anymore. You know, protesters can't have signs.
All right. We should say also there seems to be major construction going on in your house right now. So I don't want anybody to sort of, I don't want one of those things like, hey, how come nobody notices that? That's all right. But yes, the defund, it does feel like they're complaining about the protests, and which is for politicians, it's basically like we're going to complain about the fact that it's raining, as a, you know, like I'm sorry, that exists. We know the data. We know that registration went up significantly in the wake of the BLM protests. We know that at least on the presidential level, without that registration, without that surge of votes from urban centers, that you may not have a President Biden right now. And so they're looking for a scapegoat, and it seems to me. And what was interesting to me, and this is the thing that I really do appreciate about AOC, is that her response was less about adopt this ideological perspective and more about you need to get best practices. I mean, she talked about digital space, but even Doug Jones, who lost in Alabama, had a quote in the Washington Post, I think it was, where he said the problem with the DCCC and the DSCC is that they invest in candidates. They don't invest in voters. In other words, there's no organizing going on. It is like, we've got an election 6 weeks out. Now it's time to just, you know, pour money into the candidates. And this is what it seems to me is what AOC has been saying too. And a lot of like reformers of the Democratic Party apparatus, not necessarily from an ideological perspective, they sometimes correlate, but you can have a fight over the ideology and you can also have a fight over the apparatus and the best practices. And it seems to me like there's a conflation. When Jim Clyburn weighs in and says, this is about defund the police and blah, 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 as opposed to, hey, how come there's no on the ground organizing? The one place that we saw it was in Georgia, right? Where there's been an apparatus. Right.
To even further buttress your point, the other place we saw it was in Arizona, because largely Latino groups there had been organizing against Sheriff Arpaio for a decade plus, and had over the past several years gotten an influx of investment nationally to allow them to really build on the organizing that they'd been doing over all of those years. And so you had this community that organized for a particular political goal. They accomplished that goal, throwing our pile out. And in accomplishing that goal, they built political power and they built a political constituency that had solidarity with the people that stood with them through that fight. And they were able to deliver Arizona for Biden and for Democrats. But you're right, that doesn't happen anywhere else. And there's this kind of mismatch between the way that Democrats are approaching politics and the kind of populist moment that we're in right now. And Doug Jones understands that, because he understands that there are so many of these weird voters in Alabama who just, they hate both leaderships of both parties and are actually persuadable between the kind of two wildly different wings of the two different parties. And, you know, because he's been going around Alabama for so long, he has seen that. Whereas the kind of Washington Democrat approach is to say, all right, we're going to run a bunch of polls and we're going to see which particular message, if we drop $1 million on it in the local TV network, is going to move the polling numbers, you know, 3 points over the course of the next 2 weeks. And they do that polling and it turns out that people want their drug prices to be lower than they want them to be higher, if those are their choices. Yeah, how about that? Lower.
All right. Well,
if you need to write that down so you can remember that, people want lower drug prices. And if you have a pre-existing condition, that you are entitled to continue to live. So they poll those things and those poll quite well. They cut those ads. They re-poll a week or two later after they've spent $1 million running these ads on TV. The people remember seeing those ads. They remember the name. The polling numbers go up. Everybody gets a cut along the way, you know, whether it's somewhere between 8 and 15% of whatever that media buy was, everybody's happy. You go to the polls. It turns out that didn't really sink in, because of course everybody likes low drug prices, but what else is going on and what else does the Democratic Party represent? Who does it represent? What organizing has gone on in the community to show that this is a party that you ought to have solidarity with at the polls? And so you're right. There may be this disconnect between just the fundamental way that Democrats think they ought to campaign and the intensity of the populist moment that we're in now.
What did the argument from the moderates, I mean, on some level, there seems to be like a there's a there's sort of a bait and switch quality to this argument, it seems to me, right? Where you have the more sort of like grassroots oriented and ideologically to the left Democrats, and although, you know, Doug Jones, I guess, you know, maybe relative to Alabama, he's to the left, but I mean, he's making this argument too. You need to invest in the district, not in the politician. You need to build an apparatus on the ground that exists separate from and is more durable than a certain campaign that an individual is going to run at any given time. I mean, that to me seems like a very basic message. And frankly, I mean, if I was, you know, the squad, I would be traveling around with Doug Jones talking about that, because, you know, apparently they can't undercut his message by saying he's so far to the left, he doesn't know what it is to run in some place outside of New York, right? I mean, that to me seems like to be the clearest expression of somebody who understands the dynamic that's going on here. What was ostensibly the message that the moderates were running on that got stepped on? Like, what was the message? Was it just, we're going to protect your pre-existing conditions? That was the whole message?
Well, the moderate message was, I think, pretty well summed up by the Joe Biden campaign, which is that we're going to get rid of Donald Trump, we're going to restore decency, but nothing will fundamentally change. And that's the message that these moderates want. You know, it was seen as a gaffe when Biden said that, but it wasn't. That's the message that moderates wanted to convey to a lot of the suburban voters who, you know, they were winning over in 2018 and to lesser extent 2016, and that they were kind of banking the rise of this new Democratic Party on. And unfortunately, it feels like it worked too well.
Well, yes. So, I mean, yes, if you
got
tell
Biden.
Me. Right, right. Exactly. Exactly. And the Democrats did nothing to tie the Republican Party to Donald Trump. So the idea was like, I got you. You're right. We're going to get rid of Donald Trump and nothing else will change. Nothing. I won't change anything else. I mean,
keep the House as it is. Keep the Senate as it is. Yeah.
That is, I mean, that to me seems like an unbelievably short-sighted message. I mean, it's pretty obvious, like, okay, it works for Joe Biden because Joe Biden's the one actually running against Donald Trump. But if you go around and you put down Republicans, you platform them at your convention and you talk about the good Republicans and you embrace other Republicans and you say secretly they're telling us we don't like Donald Trump, but they won't say it publicly. Well, then how do you hope that the person you're running against for Congress is going to be tainted by Donald Trump? You've just basically given the entire script for your challenger.
Right. And so people like Katko in Syracuse, that where the Democrats were running against her, or Bacon in Omaha, those are fairly popular, well-liked Republicans who, if you're sending the message that, you know, Republicans aren't the problem, the problem is Donald Trump and bad Republicans, then it's quite reasonable for a voter in Syracuse or Omaha to say, okay, well, I actually like my guy, Representative Katko, and this Representative Bacon, he's a nice guy. I've seen him at an event. He's not like Donald Trump. And another thing that Republican operatives have said is that it's not that Democrats really tried hard to tie Trump to a lot of these Republicans, but it's also difficult to do because Trump is such a unique figure. And so you're just some boring politician is not Trump. So you have to say, well, they're Trump enablers. And, they created the conditions that allowed somebody like Trump to come into power. And so for their cowardice, for their enabling, they are therefore bad and they need to go, whether or not they spoke at the Little League event or not. But you said it really well, because Kasich and others spoke at the convention. These are good Republicans.
It's also not a project you can do over the course of a 3-month campaign. Like, you need to start this 4 years ago. You need to start this 4 years ago where you tie Donald Trump to the Republicans, and the Democrats have refused in a, I mean, just a virulent way to do that. They, I mean,
right.
Like,
they, right. It's they, been, they aggressively wanted to go the other way because they, you're right. They wanted to be validated by all of these never Trump Republicans and have their view that Trump is somebody different. And that there are good Republicans. You know, MSNBC is, no offense to Peacock, has, you know, a ton of Republicans who make, who tell the MSNBC viewing audience that, look, this is, well, you know, these are bad Republicans. We're the good Republicans. So
without a doubt. I mean, but it's not, you know, it's not a, it's not Comcast's, you know, job to say that Republicans have enabled right. Donald Trump. I mean, honestly, right. like, I mean, I, you know, I mean, I'm not, if it was up to me, I wouldn't program it that way because I'm, you know, attempting to make that point about Republicans, but right. the Democrats have, I mean, because I think your assessment is true, but the Democrats, they need to do this first, right? Like if they're not cleaving, if they're not tying Donald Trump or their local congressman to Donald Trump or Mitch McConnell to Donald Trump or Paul Ryan, who incidentally was one of those people who pushed this whole California voting late votes coming in 2017. That's suspicious. I mean, there has been many opportunities to tie the Republicans to Donald Trump. And daring them, you know, to vote against them, like, you know, put the vote for that stimulus, make Mitch McConnell either vote against him or not, like make them actually behave in the way that they're communicating. Again, it gets back to, you know, Chris Coons basically saying, we're going to give Republicans the advantage of supporting Donald Trump when they want to, but also the advantage of them actually not really supporting Donald Trump. And so if we get rid of Donald Trump, they'll be fine. I mean, Joe Biden said this over and over and over again. He told people we need a Republican Party. And he said this during yeah. the campaign. And it helped him. Go ahead.
No, Pelosi said the exact same thing. We need a strong Republican Party. And Biden talked about having a Republican as his running mate. And everyone in the audience, when he said that, laughed. And he like chased. He was like, no. I'm not telling a joke here. I'm serious. I would love to have a Republican as my running mate. I don't think that there are any right now that because of the current, you know, conditions that I could put on my ticket. But I would do it. And so that if that's the signal that you're sending to voters, then there shouldn't be any surprise at all that voters said, OK, well, then we'll do Biden and a bunch of Republicans.
So are there any figures in the Democratic Party other than, you know, what we've heard from Tlaib and from AOC who have this a similar perspective on what went wrong? Or is it or are we going to just hear that it's the progressives' fault and, you know, go through this cycle again?
Well, Schumer is the most fascinating case because, yes, like he has a re-election in 2022 and would much prefer to avoid a primary challenge rather than grapple with primary challenge. At the same time, Schumer is quite a well-known political animal. You know, this is somebody who has spent his entire life kind of, you know, reading political tea leaves and divining what the correct direction is. And I do get the sense that he actually is aware of the realignment and the populist anger that's out there. It's not obvious that he's going to be able to be the one that can lead it. He's formerly known as Wall Street Chuck. It's not going to be easy for somebody to transition like that. But he does appear to get it. And if he gets it, there are a lot of other senators who trust his kind of political judgment. And so whether they have the capacity to not just absorb that new environment, but actually act on it is a is an open question at the very best. So it may be that you just need a whole new crop of leaders who get it. But it is starting to dawn on a significant number of Democrats in Washington that what the stakes are in this fight. You would have thought that November 2016 would have brought about this kind of evolution in their thinking and in their understanding of who their opposition is. It did for a few, but particularly Trump resisting the results of the election and a significant number of Republicans, or basically the entire Republican Party, going along with him publicly, has been even more of a wake up call. But like I said, if you've been doing things the same way,
I mean, how many times do you get a wake up call? It's like they keep getting the wake up call, and then they say,
"Yeah, it's noon now."
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, all right. So lastly, what about in the House? I mean, that's all well and good in the Senate, but if they don't control the Senate, then it really doesn't matter what Chuck Schumer's saying, frankly.
Right. No, the House seems to be further behind in just kind of intellectually and politically in catching up with the moment. And part of it is just the nature of the institution. It's kind of like a middle school cafeteria. It has so many different cliques revolving around that cafeteria and tossing food at each other and talking about who the cool kids are and who the losers are, that it very quickly descends into that type of kind of interpersonal knife fighting, which makes it hard to then have like a 30,000 foot analysis of where the country is headed. And even if you could have that analysis, it makes it very difficult for people to get on the same team to kind of push in that direction. Something that might be easier in a Senate where you have 48 or 50 members.
To the extent that there's any type of leadership fight, it's happening as to who's going to follow Nancy Pelosi after these 2 years.
Probably. I mean, she's going to have to work hard to lock down, with such a small majority, she can only lose a handful of votes. And so you could
to become Speaker of the House. Is that what you're saying?
Right. Okay. Right. Right. Because, the Republicans aren't going to vote for her.
Right.
And so you need a majority. And so she's going to need people like most of the squad and people like Josh Gottheimer and the No Labels crew and the Problem Solvers Caucus, all these people that have been hostile to her. She's going to need most of them to agree to vote yes on the House floor.
Is it possible that we could see a sort of trans ideological, attempt to maybe unseat her?
Anything's possible. You've had those, Tim Ryan kind of ran a trans ideological attempt to unseat her, and he might have been premature. He got beaten, quite badly, and then kind of embarrassed himself. Pretty sure he ran for president.
Yes, he did.
So he kind of drained, what capital he had with those two defeats. But it really comes down to a question of who. I think, the idea is a sound one, but the nature of the House.
Any
is that
names?
Everybody says, that's the thing.
Yeah.
No, there aren't. Yeah. That's the problem. Your right wingers, like, so Hakeem Jeffries is kicked around. Joe Crowley would be probably speaker by now if AOC hadn't knocked him out. So it would have to be somebody like Jeffries who enough progressives like, and is also comfortable with the right wing. But the left would probably rather have Pelosi than Jeffries.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I would rather a weak, non-ideologically lined leader at this point than a strong, supposedly ideologically aligned leader, because it sometimes comes in undercuts.
So anyone in that job is going to be weak, if you can only lose a few votes.
Good point.
On every vote.
Ryan Grimm, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Intercept, as always, a pleasure and very informative. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on here.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and be back in just a moment. So just about out of time. The we should just say that the ACA was in front of the Supreme Court yesterday, and it appears. We'll play a clip of John Roberts in the second half of the program. But it appears that at least Kavanaugh and Roberts are inclined to side with the three left of center justices in the idea that if Congress decided to defund the mandate or should depenalize the mandate, then in fact, Congress did think that that mandate was severable from the rest of the law. And you can find the mandate unconstitutional and still keep the law. But we won't know for several months. And we'll have more information on that as it continues. Also, it appears that, you know, we are probably just days away from Donald Trump, you know, giving up the ghost, or at the very least, some Democratic lawmakers may be stopping to pretend like this election is still in question. All right. We will talk more about that tomorrow. And for those of you who are sticking around, thanks for being with us. You can join us in the fun half. Oh, I have a correction to make. It's not just that I say concentric wrong, that it's concentric. But the other day we did a video or where we or was it a we showed clips of a or images of a Twitter exchange between Dave Rubin and Andrew Seidel. And it was pretty funny where Seidel basically called Dave Rubin out for his COVID denial. And Dave Rubin then said, "You weren't so harsh with me when you came to my house and you know, had dinner with me." And Seidel was like, "Well, then good. That should be evidence that I don't have a predisposition against you. You should stop what you're doing because it's very dangerous." And they had a DM exchange where Rubin said, "I, you know, you're being rude and I will not exchange with you." And I characterized Seidel as a libertarian. And in fact, he is not a libertarian. He's progressive. He's an atheist. He's a First Amendment attorney and an author.
Wow.
He apparently volunteered for the Democrats, but he is not a libertarian. I characterized him as such. And he said 4 years ago, he went on Rubin's show as an attorney working to educate about the state church separation. That was back when Dave Rubin was trying to build his bona fides by being, you know, associated with the New Atheists and Sam Harris. So this is one of those stories about how also Sam Harris sort of platformed Dave Rubin. Apparently Sam Harris is, you know, sadly beginning to realize that, like, what, you know, what he's been a part of. I don't know why it took him so long. He's very learned, is my understanding. And he also says he was in Dave Rubin's house because Dave Rubin's studio is in his house. So that's very convenient. So just to be clear, Andrew Seidel is not a libertarian, and I apologize about a million times. I don't know if there's anything worse I could say about a person. I'm being a little facetious. There's definitely things worse I could say about a person, but certainly.
It's risible.
Huh?
That old-fashioned word, risible or risible.
Yes.
Yeah. Calling somebody a libertarian unwarranted is risible.
Indeed. And so 1,000 apologies. Folks, we're going to head into the fun half of the program wherein we will have fun. That is the plan. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And don't forget the AM Quickie, available to you every day. Basically, by the time you wake up, unless you wake up super early. Well, it's probably there more around like when you're having your first cup of coffee. Usually there before 8 a.m. And it's some headline news that you need in a very quick and convenient package. So check that out. Also, don't forget, Nomi's doing her show today at 3 p.m., the Noma Key Show. Don't know who's on today, but she's always having great panels, and this is a great time to check out what she's saying about particularly this little fight that's going on in the Democratic Party. It will blow over, but it is people jockeying for position and power. And hopefully in the next couple of days, we're going to have Paul Rieckhoff on to do a little bit of a debate about it, because I this is what has to happen right now. Fight over Joe Biden's administration, who are going to be the personnel within it, and also a fight over, you know, the direction of the Democratic Party, whether they have the Senate in Georgia or not. So stick around for that. Also, don't forget, check out the Antifada, patreon.com/theAntifada. Jamie's got new shows. And Matt, what's happened on TMBS last night?
Gene Bajelan joined us. We talked about, you know, this infighting among the between the Dems and the centrists, or the left and the centrists, and how we should embrace it and, you know, get amongst it. We also talked about a common sense group of Tory MPs in London who are coming together to fight the cultural Marxism of the bourgeois liberals in the UK, and wanting to, like, do things like, say, Winston Churchill's estate had some connection to slavery. So it's interesting. Sort of contours of the future PC arguments, I think we've kind of seen across the Atlantic. So check that out last night, patreon.com/TMBS and the Michael Brooks Show on YouTube.
All right. We will see you in the fun half. Emma will be joining us there. See you 646-257-3920.
In for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Almost as what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danner song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck. Fuck. Reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?
Hell out of the bank. 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 Hell out of the bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black. African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black. Black.
See Donald Trump out there? Doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock us.
Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them!
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment.
for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black.
Come on! What? Come on! What? Come on!
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy, 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 pussy.